think about what you want to talk about first. That's all.
You have to think. You're not my real dad. Welcome to the Backpack Show, everybody. What do we do? Oh, where we do all kinds of work to bring you interesting people from and give insights from unusual places.
Into success. We teach you about success. And in the process, we learn a lot about it, too.
Boy, do we.
Yes. So we have two amazing guests today. We'll talk with Jen Donahue, leadership coach, engineer, and entrepreneur. She served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and she's exploring the conflict women leaders might have hiring other women. So we're going to talk about that and kind of the hiring spectrum and how all that works. It's just a little bit different. And then Bella Mahia Carter will talk about her new book, Where Do You Hang Your Hammock? And it's all about finding peace of mind while you write, publish, and promote your book. So this thing is chock full of really good advice.
Yes. Hey, there's my pop. And there's also Coach Scott Woodard.
Hey.
There's my father, Stephen Brogan. Perhaps you've heard of him.
Your biological father?
That's the one. That's
I'm so weird. Happy that he's turned that? Up. Why would I ever say that?
Welcome to the Backpack Show with your hosts, Chris Brogan and Carrie Gargone. Boom shakalaka.
Love seeing Santa in the opener.
I know. Santa and Mrs. Claus.
Santa. That's a pretty important one. So the day we talked with Santa and Mrs. Claus, we also had the first non-binary Eagle Scout on. Aaron
That's
Colton.
That's correct. Aaron Colton. So there's my mom and Kate and
Hola.
Elizabeth. Hola. And Leslie. Hi. You know, we should probably tell you this.
Guests of the show stay at the inconveniently located from downtown or anywhere, never to be confused with luxurious and never updated FDR Hotel, located somewhere off Highway 84 near an old gas station with a burned out van parked out front with a for sale sign.
He will never not be funny. He's amazing.
He's so funny. A little technical issue on my side, but you know what? I think here's what we're going to do. We're going to start with Jen Donahue because we're going to ask her some important questions, but then we're going to ask Bella. We're going to ask her all kinds of questions about book publishing, what we're supposed to be doing with that. So I want to use Bella as the hook for why to stick around to the end, because I think that's a good hook. I think that's a good get, as we say. Hey, Michelle. It's Michelle. Oh my gosh. Here we are already. This is a big day. Good to see you. So let's grab Jen Donahue first, and Bella, that means you have a few minutes. So, you know, calisthenics, whatever you want to do, anything else we may have discussed. Hi, Jen.
Hi, Chris. It's good to see you.
Happy to connect with you. So you talked about serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. What was your work over there?
So I was with the U.S. Navy, and we have a group called the Seabees. And what we do is expeditionary construction. So basically what it is we drive out to the middle of nowhere, we park the trucks in a circle, we point the guns out, and then we build in the middle. And the Marines, they come, they occupy the site, or maybe it was the Afghan army, whoever it might be, but that's what we did. So I was the commanding officer of 800 personnel while I was there in Afghanistan.
I've got a few friends who've served with the Seabees, and one of the things is that that's a group that runs really deep after service. It seems like if you ever run into each other in any kind of other setting, it's pretty much an instant extra friend right nearby. Was that the experience you had there?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I was out hiking on a trail just recently, and I walked by, and a guy had a CB hat on, and I was like, oh, my God, I'm a CB, too. And it's like we, you know, struck up a conversation right there on the trailhead. So, yeah, it's definitely a really close-knit group. Seems like we all know each other. It's a pretty small community to begin with.
How did I do that?
I was just getting all the CB love out there. Like, yay.
Love it.
So it's safe to say that you take no nonsense right, on the job.
Exactly. Working with contractors and everything else like that is not a problem anymore.
That is, so the first question I want to ask is, you know, you're going to talk a little bit about how women work with other women and how to hire them and all that, but it is definitely one of those scenarios where in Iraq and Afghanistan, you certainly have had your moments, I'm sure, where people who are a little less evolved as they should be, maybe make your job a little hard until you help educate them on how they could better interact with you. How do you manage that in general?
The one thing is I just have to stay true to myself. I know what I can do and I know what I bring to the fight. And so maybe it's just me being pigheaded. I just stick it out. And a lot of times it does take, you know, me answering their questions in a way that they understand and realize that, oh, there's actually a lot more that she knows than, you know, maybe what they just see on the surface. So that's really how I've gotten through most of those really challenging aspects. Actually, one of the really challenging ones was we were actually helping the Afghans learn how to build. And so with their culture, it's very unusual for women to, you know, especially someone who looks like me, to speak directly to them. And so there were times when I had to realize that maybe I just wasn't the right messenger and I had to find the right person to convey what I was trying to say to the Afghans in a way that they would understand it. And then over time, they started to understand, you know, wait, she's actually the one saying it, and they would come directly to me. But that, you know, this is just a cultural difference and it just takes some time, you know, to earn that type of trust.
About how long? So on the average job, when you'd go to a new place, like about how long before people figured out that you were the person actually in charge, like functionally in charge?
In Afghanistan, they realized right away that I was in charge, but it probably took about a good 2 to 3 weeks of just working with them on a day-to-day basis before they really started to realize, oh, she knows what she's talking about. She's the one in charge. She's the one that we need to go to. I've done a lot also in my civilian career, where I build runways and designed for nuclear power plants and all kinds of different things like that. And so usually it doesn't take too long, really. I just have to go in. I have to be professional. And people get it pretty quickly.
Now, you are here to talk a little bit about the challenges specifically for women hiring women and mm-hmm. some of what goes on in that circumstance as well. It's never – hiring is a crazy time anyway. But there's a lot to sort of be parsed. I'm curious first, though, or on the way to that topic, was it easy for you to make the transition to civilian life? Was it easy for you to take your leadership skills that you picked up in the Navy and bring them out to civvy world? Or was it just kind of like, oh, gosh, I've got to really reset myself and figure it all out again?
Well, the first thing that I realized is that I can't just yell at people and make them do push-ups whenever they do something wrong. So that was the first thing that I learned. But other than that, it wasn't too bad because I do work with civilians a lot in the Navy. And so I started to understand that whenever I speak to my troops, it's one way. Whenever I speak to civilians, it's usually something different. So whenever I transitioned to the civilian world, I just basically took that same skill set and applied it. But one of the things that I really noticed whenever I did get into the civilian world is that there really wasn't a lot of leadership training that people were getting, especially these young professionals, these young engineers and scientists. They weren't getting any type of training. And I mean, in the military, like from day one, whenever, you know, we got the drill instructors that are spitting in your face and telling you to get on the ground and do push-ups, they start leadership training like that very first day. And so that's one of the things that I've really kind of taken on as a mantle. It's like, I feel like I need to help these young professionals be better leaders and give them those tips and tricks to be better leaders, you know, not whenever they become middle management or later, but just start at the beginning. So that's one of the things that I've really noticed, you know, about that transition into the civilian world.
That there's no training? Yeah, I've noticed that too. I think everyone has. So when you're leading men and women in the military, how do you come back over to the kind of the private sector where we have a lot of, there's still a ton of embedded biases that people are actively ignoring, you know, and they're not promoting women all the time or right. even assigning them important projects. How can you kind of correct for that? Like you're coming into it with a completely different perspective on leadership and it could be uncomfortable for some established people.
Right. So a couple different ways that I would go about this. One is you have to be your most professional self. So that's on, you know, that's on you. But then also see if you can find a mentor, maybe somebody that's in a greater position of power and try to get them to mentor you. And a lot of times, you know, they'll see an interest in that fire and that drive in you and they'll pull you up with them and try and basically they'll vouch for others in their own peer group. And then also whenever you start to get into those leadership positions, then it's really incumbent upon you to really kind of look down and see where that talent is and try to promote that talent. And if you're seeing that that's not really happening because of different biases or whatever it might be, you have to stand up. That's your job as a leader, as somebody in any type of position of power. That's your job to stand up for others.
So like if somebody were to drag you out front when you didn't offer to co-host the show with them, that would be dragging you along with them, right? Through your ultimate benefit.
Yeah, you might want to discuss that offline, yeah.
So now let's talk a little bit about the difference in hiring between hiring fellas, hiring ladies. What is the difference? What makes it a difference? What's good, bad, difficult, and otherwise about making that situation happen? And what brought this topic to light for you?
So in the last part of 2020, what they found was almost the majority of people who were either laid off or had to quit their job, the majority, like 75% of them, were women. And so now we're starting to try to right the ship as we're coming out of COVID. And the question is like, okay, how do we go through that hiring process? And so I'm from the engineering world and I'm used to a very male dominated type of environment. And so I started talking to some of my other colleagues about like, you know, what do we do about this? You know, it feels like we need more women in higher positions of leadership, you know, because then you get a real diversity of thought. They take on challenges differently. Maybe they had other obstacles that they had to overcome, but you kind of get more of that flavor, you know, of individuality and also diversity at the same time. So as I was talking to my colleagues about this, what I found was that there's this huge spectrum of the way that people believe that they should hire women. So on the one side, you know, especially in some of the sciences and engineering and some of those male dominated areas, there are some women who are the hardliners. And so they're on the like the very left side of the spectrum. And the way that they believe it is like, you know what, I had to suffer. I had to prove myself. I had to work harder than anybody else. And so, you know what, until you get to that point, I'm not even going to look at you or even try to bring you up. And so that's one side, you know, it's like, and so I see a little bit of that, you know, it's like, hey, you know what, I actually had to work really hard myself also to make sure that I was ready for these different positions. And then
In case people didn't realize, you're an engineer. Like it's in that long litany of accomplishments that you just mentioned in passing, engineer.
I am an engineer. I'm an engineer's engineer. So I have a calculator behind me. Okay, so then on the other side of the spectrum, there's another side, this other group, which is, I call them basically the super supporters. And so they are all about realizing that maybe as a female or an underrepresented group, maybe they had a different path that they had to get to where they want to be. Maybe they had different obstacles or challenges or something that held them back. You know, maybe they decided to take a couple years off and raise children, or maybe they had some kind of other discrimination against them that maybe they don't look the same on paper as their other counterparts. And so they're like, hey, you know, no matter what, you know, I'm going to try to reach down, find that female and bring her up. So you have this wide spectrum of the super supporters, and then you got the hardliners. And in talking to a lot of my female colleagues who are now in these positions to hire, you know, both men and women, you know, we kind of go back and forth, and a lot of us have those same tendencies, and it kind of tears us apart a little bit to realize that, yeah, I really did work super hard to get here, but also I need to maybe look to see if maybe this person, maybe on paper, they don't look the same as their colleagues, but maybe they bring something else to the fight. So this is one of those things that we have to think about and kind of realize, hey, what side of the spectrum are we on? And so that we can try to make the corrective action for that.
Elizabeth had a question. Do you feel that we're personally responsible for professional development?
Yes, I absolutely believe professional development is something that needs to be done more. You know, we have all of these young engineers, scientists, professionals, you know, medical, financial, whatever they might be, you know, and they are hungry. I mean, these folks are really hungry for professional development. And for those of us that have been around in the, you know, the industry for a couple of years, it's like we need to think about how are we going to help them be better. So many of us made a lot of mistakes whenever we were younger, maybe because we didn't have a mentor. And now's the chance. It's like, hey, let's give back. Let's give them a little bit of help. Let's give them the professional development that they could actually be better than we are.
Kate asked, who is your mentor?
I have a couple of mentors. So one of my mentors is Norm Abrahamson. So if you ever Google him, I think he has something like 60,000 different papers on engineering seismology. He was one of my technical mentors. And he's the one who really saw something in me and brought me up. And that's how I started my own company, how I've worked for nuclear power plants and designed bridges. It's all because of him. But I also have other mentors. Rudy Bonaparte is a fantastic businessman. And so I learned a lot from Rudy. And so it's okay to have several different mentors because they all bring something different to the table. Maybe it's technical, maybe it's something in your personal life, maybe it's business, you know, so have a couple of different mentors and don't be afraid to go out and ask.
One of the things that I saw in your responses was just the fact that you're talking through all the different ways that people have to develop and all that. The question Elizabeth asked about, you know, what do you think about people developing personally? I think it's always better that the individual goes and does that extra work, because what that shows is, of course, drive and self-motivation and that, all that sense of if you have to weigh between two people and one of them's out in front of everything versus the other person just waiting to see what gets dropped in their bucket, right? You know what kind of person they're going to be when they launch.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have to have that fire and you have to have that drive. That's how you're going to get ahead. Whether it's in, and I tell everybody, read technical manuals, read professional manuals, read how to be a better person. Continually read and try to be better, either in your job or in your personal life.
JC had a couple of comments. First, heard of the Society of American Military Engineers.
Yes.
And hey, PhD in civil engineering. It's like PR. That's awesome.
Dr. Donahue, to everybody else.
That's right.
Yes. So, go ahead.
Oh, Elizabeth wanted to know what the transition was like from engineering and military life to civilian life in terms of changing communication styles and things like that.
I learned that I had to be a little bit softer when I spoke to people, and I had to read people a lot better. So really what that means is that, you know, a lot of times in the military, it's like, you just go tell somebody, hey, I need you to do this. I need you to do it right now. And they're like, roger that, the salute, and they go. But that doesn't really work that way very well in the civilian world. And so I had to understand how to read people, because if I had that type of attitude towards one person, I might send them crying to the bathroom. But if there's others, I had to be even more forceful and stand up straighter and be more direct with them in order for my message to get through. And so really on the civilian side, reading people and that emotional intelligence is really what I had to learn a whole lot more about, because I actually did send somebody crying to the bathroom once, and it doesn't feel very good. So I definitely learned and went and apologized and, you know, had to dial it back a little bit. So
I had the opportunity to interview a few years back Christopher Till, who is a Navy SEAL commander or a squad leader, I think. And he has a restaurant. It's a pizza / bowling alley place called Easy Day up in Portland, Maine. And I asked him that same question. And he said, you know, when I turn to my pothead floor mopper person at the pizza place and say, hey, I need you to get that handled right now. Absolutely. Sure thing, boss. And the guy will take off and you'll see the mess will be on the floor for a day or so. And he's just like, it took him such a long time to not be ballistic when he saw stuff laying around.
It's true.
Fazia wants to know, do you use the PhD with your name?
I do in certain settings. And so I'm a PhD professional engineer and project manager professional. So I'm a PhD, PE, PMP. So I know it's like one of my mentors actually said, he with the most, you know, acronyms after their name wins.
Sounds like a fold-out business card, Jen.
But no, I don't always use it, but from time to time, it does help.
Share a leadership mistake that you've made. Well, Kate, if you view sending someone to the bathroom crying as a mistake, I guess that'd be one. No, I am a lawyer, so we used to keep track of how many people we made to cry. It was like a point of pride.
So the biggest mistake that I had, especially as a young leader, was trying to adapt a leadership style that wasn't mine. I was looking at a lot of these other, you know, senior officers, and they were yellers. They were big men, and they were like yelling at people to make them do what they needed to do. And so I thought, oh, well, that's, I guess, how you become a leader is you turn around and yell at people. And so I did that, and I turned around and I yelled at my staff. And it just really felt horrible. And I'm like, wow, this is not the way it should be. So I had to really go back and reflect a lot about like how my leadership style was, because I mean, you know, that was back in like 1998. And it's still one of those things that just kind of haunts me, like, wow, I can't believe I did that. That was a horrible thing to do. So no, I've definitely made my mistakes.
So you switched over to like more Marlon Brando and Apocalypse Now. Just be quieter. I'd be like intimidating.
Quieter. Yeah. I need you to do this for me.
Jen Donahue, stick around. We have a little panel we'll bring you back on, and we'll also ask you the backpack question. Thank you so much for being on today.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for having me.
A lot of fun. All right. We have a few ads, and then we got to talk to Bella Mahia Carter. We're going to talk about book publishing. We're going to talk about where in the heck should we hang our hammock. I don't really know the answer to that. I would need some engineering help for that, I think.
Probably.
So let's read a couple quick ads. We have some quick ads. Castos. That's an ad. Okay.
If you want an audio podcast hosted on castos.com, it's super easy. You know it is because we use it. So it has to be.
Hey, you want a .online domain? $1 for an entire year. cbrogan.me/online. Use Chris in all caps. You can have your own .online domain. Hey, we're sponsored by StreamYard. You can have your own video show just like this. Super easy. Works just fine.
People are upset you're not booping like you did before. Is you not booping because it's after dark, asks Michelle? Why are you?
I don't know. I boop. StreamYard. Carrie's not answering. But okay. Hey, want to go to a course? Who wouldn't? You can go to pulveredu.com to look at one cool class. 7 Jeff coins for a class. Yes, you
That's
can
so
use
cool.
really cool rally coins.
You pay
to go to
in
class.
Creator coin?
Yes.
What?
Yeah. You can even supposedly use backpack coins, but we haven't tested it out yet. Huh. Now, I've been in an experiment for a week or so, and we're going to have some conversations about that with the guy who runs the company a little later this week. Presearch. Presearch.com is a search engine where you don't give up all the goods to Google. You don't let them know where you're looking. It's private, Bippos. Also, you can earn crypto awards. Although I just realized why I'm not is because I forgot to sign up and make a full account and all that.
So you're just using it with no
I'm just
account.
Using it. I'm not getting coins.
You're a searching fool.
I'm a searching fool, but I'm going to get paid before any of you get paid for using Google. All right. That's it. I think I had all my ads. Seems like some ads.
Bumpy.
I booped. I mean, I have booped. You can't reverse boop.
Well,
boob. Hi, Bella.
Hi.
That's a reverse boop. So welcome and thank you so much for being part of this today. Why did you name your book what you named it? Because I've been puzzling over that the whole time.
I'll tell you a story.
You.
About 10 years ago, my husband and daughter gave me a fabulous Mother's Day gift. It was a hammock. And the only problem was we didn't really have any place to put it. So we cleared a spot on the side of the house and we set up this hammock and I loved it. I went out to the hammock whenever I could to relax at the end of the day. And it was really my happy place. It was my peaceful place. And then one day I went to my happy place and something wasn't happy anymore. Something was different and I wasn't sure what it was. And then I looked up at the sky and I realized that the branch that had been there was a tree on my neighbor's side of the fence and a hole and the limb went through the hole in the hammock and provided shade for my hammock. And he had cut, without asking us, he had cut down the limb to this tree. And so I had no shade. So I was just exposed. And at first I was really angry and I avoided my hammock. And I thought, how could he have done this to me? And I was just frustrated and upset. And then I realized that one day I just had to get in my hammock. And so I went outside, I tore down a rotting redwood trellis and I dragged my hammock and I moved it to a spot and I got into my hammock and I looked up and I said, wow, this is beautiful. Oleander sky. Like, why didn't I do this sooner? And the reason I hadn't done it sooner was that I was attached to this idea that it had to look a certain way. My hammock had to be in that spot. I've since moved my hammock many times in different parts of my yard and have discovered that there isn't a bad place in my yard for my hammock. But at that time, I didn't see that. And then I realized what a great metaphor this story was for the experience that I had when I went to go publish my memoir. Things didn't unfold the way I expected. When I was looking for an agent, they wanted me to be a raw food expert, and that's not who I am and what I do. And so I just had to make decisions all along the way to move my hammock, to actually just make it work for me, to live my life from the inside out. And that's how I got the title, Where Do You Hang Your Hammock? It's a metaphor for where do you get your peace of mind?
Fazia Burke says hi. She's
hi,
my
Fazia.
Very favorite book publicist.
Nice to see you.
Fazia Burke.
Fazia's awesome.
Fazia Book Burke.
Yeah, Book is her middle name.
Mm-hmm. So as I was looking through your books, I mean, you have quite an interesting collection. You have Ra, you have your new book, of course, with the hammock, and you have also your collection of poems, Secrets of My Sex. These are all very different places. You must have been in very different places in your heart, head, and plans as you put these books together.
They're actually all thematically related. They all have to do with living life from the inside out. They all have to do with figuring out who am I, why am I here? What am I doing? What's important? How can I be of service? The first book, Secrets of My Sex, is a collection of poetry. And, you know, that was just, as a young woman, I just felt like, well, you know, sex is something that people don't talk about. In those days, they didn't talk about it. And so I felt like I needed to claim my voice and talk about that, my experiences. And that was a very healing project for me. And then the memoir also, the original title of the memoir had been A Midlife Quest for Health and Happiness. And it wasn't until after I'd written the book that I realized that actually it was about anxiety and my struggle with anxiety, which I didn't really know I'd had. I had chronic stomach problems for many years. And I had been reading a lot about the raw food diet. And I thought, well, let me try this diet. And it was pretty awesome. I had a lot of energy. I felt great, but it wasn't the panacea that I had imagined. So I thought, well, what would a raw food diet for the mind look like? And I enrolled in a master's degree program in spiritual psychology and discovered that a lot of my thinking was preventing me from living my life fully. And it really wasn't until toward the end of my writing the book, when we had 5 family deaths in 3 years, and I was the executor of a contentious estate, when I developed an anxiety disorder. And the doctors, they wanted to give me medication, which sometimes I had to take it, but I also understood that my body was communicating with me, and I wanted to learn the lesson, and I wanted to learn what is this, and how does this work, and what can I learn from it? And then this book, Where Do You Hang Your Hammock? It's a collection of, it really represents 10 years worth of writing that I've done in these various categories, which I break down in the book as dream, nourish, write, publish, and promote. And it's really geared for writers who want to maintain not only their sanity, but their joy as they write, publish, and promote their books.
I mean, joy is a pretty tall order. Most people just want to kind of get by. You still keep things balanced to the extent possible.
Joy. That's what I'm looking for. That's the direction where I point people as a coach and as a teacher. Where is the joy and where is the love? And if it's not anywhere here, maybe you should be doing something different.
I'm only speaking as myself. The first 9 books I wrote just fell out of me. Like, hey, this is what you do. You write books. Okay, here's another. And then it has been since 2015 that I haven't published another book for lots of reasons. My question is that right now, so there's all these cliches around writing. One of the cliches is that you kind of like fight with your writing and you wrestle it. No one ever wants to write. They want to have written. I never believed any of those things, except right now I sure wish I would have written. What does the book say about that? What does your book tell me I should be doing to get better with myself?
Yeah, the book would say, stop fighting. Stop fighting. Start listening.
Video games it is.
What was that?
Video games it is.
Oh, you're such a smart aleck.
Stop writing.
I mean, eventually you'll get tired of video games and you'll want to do your writing. I think that for me, there's like four lessons. One is slow down. Because I don't know about you, but my mind, it just goes so fast that it often just hijacks me. I'm not present. I'm in my head. I'm moving in 100 directions at once. So slow down. And then stop fighting is the second part of this. and then like let go and see what wants to be expressed through you. I would say show up, do some writing in your journal, see what comes out, and don't have any expectations. Don't ask it to do anything for you. Don't ask it to be anything for you. Just show up and see what's there. Because there's probably a lot there. You probably have a lot to say.
Boy, does he. Elizabeth has a question. Do you believe that your thoughts affect your health? And does your book help advise how to reverse bad thinking? Love, joy, and is one of my three. Oh, one of my three words.
Oh, I love this question. I absolutely do think that our. Oh, could you keep the question back on there?
Yeah, for sure.
Because it's such a good question. Your thoughts affect your health. Absolutely. And in ways that we can't even imagine. And the book does talk about this a lot. And I don't talk about reversing bad thinking. I talk about cultivating a different kind of relationship with your thinking. Because we don't control the thoughts that come into our heads. But we, if we're aware of what's happening, we can decide how to respond to those thoughts. And that's a game changer, especially when it comes to thoughts like fearful thoughts, anxious thoughts. Because I have had the experience many times of being completely hijacked by my thinking. But now I understand the process. I understand what's going on. So when that starts to happen, and I actually feel it physically, it's a visceral, my body will tell me when I'm having anxious thinking. I may not be consciously aware of my anxious thinking, but my body will tell me when it's happening. And when that happens, I instead of going, oh, shit, I'm spinning, I'm you know, and then going into more crazy thinking, instead I just say, oh, wait a minute. I need to stop. I need to slow down. I need to take a breath. And I also need to let it be okay that I'm feeling this way. And then it dissolves.
So you find that your best thoughts occur to you when you're not trying, like when you're just listening?
I really like that question because I don't think we have to try. I think there's a kind of a brilliance in all of us, and we just get in our own way. And so we just layer on a bunch of thinking, like I'm not good enough, I have nothing valuable to say. You know, we just have all this thinking that just, it dampens down just our natural gifts. And when we know that, when we can trust that those gifts are there, and we can distrust the thinking that says, whatever the limiting thought is, you're not good enough, you suck, who cares what you want to say? When we can just put that aside and know, okay, we all have that, right? It's universal doubt. My problem was that for years I took it personally. I thought it was all about me. I believed it. I believed that voice in my head with all those thoughts. And you know, it took me a long time to figure out, like, you know what, we all have those thoughts. They're universal, they're not personal. And I don't have to believe them.
I have a question about what's changed in the land of promotion since the Great Apocalypse. I mean, obviously, we couldn't do this in person for quite some amount of time. How does your book handle that? And sort of where do we go from here now that the world is reopening?
The way I think about promotion is that really it's an opportunity to just share and to be of service. It's not about selling. It's not about it's not about trying to prove anything. It's really about sharing what's in our hearts and being of service and helping people. And when we start to think about promotion in that way, then, you know, we don't feel scuzzy. We don't feel like, ooh, you know, like, and it can be really hard. It can be really hard to just put yourself out there and ask for what you want. But I think a lot of people have great things to share. And there are others that will benefit from what they have to share. And so when I'm doing my promotional work, I just assume that there are people out there that will benefit from what I'm sharing. And so I think of it as an act of generosity of spirit.
What are some ways that people can nourish themselves when they're trying to get into that creative space?
Well, I would say it depends on who you are. I think the first thing would be to know what are the things that nourish you. So you might keep a journal. You know, for me, I can tell you what I do. I love the sharing is caring. Yes, Kate, that's true. The things that I do to nourish myself, I mean, they can be as simple as just sit outside and drink a cup of tea. It can be slow down. It could be just stop what you're doing, sit in your chair, you know, sit straight in your chair and close your eyes. Maybe just put your hand on your heart, your hand, other hand on your belly, and take 10 breaths. You'd be surprised. I mean, so many times I say, okay, I'm going to do 10. I'm going to take 10 breaths. And I sit down and it's breath three. And my mind is going, I got to do this. I got to do this. I got to do this. And I'm constantly coming back, come back, come back, quiet. And then just actually to take 10 breaths can be really helpful. Baths. I love water, hiking, grab my backpack, go out on the trail. It just depends on what, I mean, I have a joy and well-being list, and I have like a list of things that I love to do. And when I really get in one of those moods and I just don't know what to do, I'll look at my joy and well-being list and I'll say, I think I'll do that.
Number 17 today.
Exactly.
This book is the current book, but this is in a series of books at this point. Are you already on to the next book, or is that how you work? Do you have a pause in between, or what do you do?
Well, that's a good question. I have several projects in the works that have been in the works for some time, but I told my publicist that I'd give her a list of article ideas that she could pitch to various media outlets. And in doing that, in putting that list together, I was rating my files. And, you know, I write in my journal regularly, and then I have little sticky notes that I put on the page, and I just keep files of stuff that I've been writing about and things I want to say. And I ended up, you know, after an hour looking at all the material of what I've been working on over the last year, and I sent her a list of 40 ideas. And I thought, oh, wait a minute, this could easily be an outline for my next book, which would be a continuation on the book that I've just written. But it wasn't something that I planned. It wasn't, you know, I thought I was going to work on a different book. So I just trust the process. I trust what unfolds. And I never know. I mean, who knows? I mean, I love thinking I don't know. I love that, because then it opens me up. It's when I start thinking I know, then my world gets smaller.
So that brings me back to this comment from Kat saying, if we stop trying to fill the space with our own voice, we can hear intuition, inspiration, etc. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fazia Book Burke says, slow down is great advice. I often tell authors who are stressing about promoting their book to do less and not more. And JC says several of Bella's students have started their next book in her writing classes. And Chris, Kate wants to know if you're still journaling.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, Chris, sorry.
She's asking me. No. Yeah. Journals are places where it's basically a free pile of mud underneath my wheels. So I find that with journaling, I am using calories there that I would normally use just to write into book pages. So I don't find great value in it myself, but I am a very different human, and there's lots of different ways to get there, and it's just not my one. I keep starting and stopping, and then I realized one day, hey, maybe I don't need to journal. So I'm good. But that's very.
That's the answer, Kate.
No, I'm not journaling. No. I hate it. Never helps for me. One last question, though, in that whole process, though, is there are different students for different teachers. I would imagine. Oh, I'm not clubhousing. Ugh. if you could have picked any other activity to do with my time besides journaling as in like a level of things I would least want to do, filling out forms. That's the only thing I could think I would least want to do than Clubhouse. So I was going to say there's a lot of ways that authors get to where they get to. How do you help sort of shake them a little bit loose? How do you pull the plaque out of them, Bella? Because every now and again, and the answer could be journaling. Every now and again, people just get knocked into a loop or something, or worse, the one I hate the most is that sort of imposter problem that people run into. What do you do with that?
Yeah, it's all about the thinking. It's the thinking. I mean, if they're feeling like an imposter, I would say, you know, okay, so that's a thought, and that's an interesting thought. Is that a helpful thought? So if the person realizes, no, it's not a helpful thought, it's getting in the way, I can't do what I want to do, I would say, so how about if you just like say, okay, thought, I know you're there, I hear you, but you know what, I'm just not going to really believe you right now. I'm going to do what I want to do because I have this stuff I want to do. So, you know, you can hang out if you want, but I'm not going to be listening to you. So, and in terms of getting people, the reason why people aren't creating and really showing up in the ways that they want to, it always has to do with something, some thought that's going on. And so what I try to do is just get down to what that thought is and just, tease out the thought and then see if we can change the relationship between the person and that thought. It's not about making the thought go away. It's about, like, how can we hold that thought a little differently so that you can be free?
I'm into that. I like that answer a lot. That's a very, very interesting way to do it.
Kate wants to clarify that she was joking about Clubhouse.
Yeah.
And Kat thinks it's funny.
Mm-hmm. And never ask Chris to be a secret shopper. Okay. I won't be.
Too many forms.
Mm-hmm.
I don't
All right.
know.
We're going to grab our new other friend, Dr. Jen Donahue, and bring her back. Watch this.
Oh, going to be on the same side as in the green room. It's them
Jen,
rules.
What do you think? Is this inspiring you to get that journaling and penning going?
Actually, I was going to say I need to get Bella's book because I'm in the process of writing a book proposal right now. So I definitely need to get the book, read through it, and really excited to see what she has to say.
And I have to say, Jen, I'm so excited to listen to what you had to say. My husband is actually on the board with the Society of American Military Engineers.
Well, they're having their big conference this week.
Yeah, he's part of it.
How funny is that? We didn't plan that, by the way. Kat says, strongly recommend internal family systems to those who want to have conversations with those thoughts. I guess the thoughts about, like, you're not good enough or you're an imposter and things like that. Internal family systems. If you knew my family, you would not say things like that. But
no, that's a kind of therapy. They don't mean your real family.
I was going to say. Love all the great advice in this show, says Fazia. And Kate's asking if this was planned, that connection between the two of you. Absolutely not. Nope. That is alchemy. That's what emerges.
We have a plan.
Yeah. So we're just happy to be here.
The world is a very small place, and there are many interactions between everybody. So that doesn't surprise me at all.
So we have a couple more things left to do on this show. One of them is this.
Oh, and here's our person of the day. Kaboom!
Oh, and let us see. We have so many choices. Carrie, do you want a shot at the person of the day? I mean, it could be fun.
Do I get to?
You could do it. Could be Fozzie Book Burke because she hasn't been around lately. But no,
I love her to pieces, but I'm going to pick Kat.
Oh, I think so, too.
Because Kat made a couple of really good
pre-ordered
observations.
Pre-ordered the book on Amazon. This book has been pre-ordered. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Yay. So, Kat, that gets you an apple. All you have to do is go and buy it and wash it really good.
Mm-hmm.
And you're all set.
Yep.
Although, I can send you some backpack coin if you give me a rally ID.
I think she has a rally ID too. All right. And then we have one question that we've asked every guest we've ever asked on the show, from Butterscotch, the 5-time world beatboxing champion, to
Sister Ann Flanagan of the Daughters of St. Paul.
Robert Cialdini, Dr. Robert Cialdini, of Influence Author. What goes in your backpack? Now, this could be something. Yes, you win an apple. This goes anything from something physical to something metaphorical. Carrie, what's a good physical thing you could throw in a backpack?
Extra set of teeth. Sticking with it.
That's a pretty good one. Now, what would be a metaphorical thing someone could add to their backpack?
Kindness.
Kindness is a really good one, I think. I think that's pretty smart.
All right. Avocado, says Michelle, and Kat wants an iWatch. You can have my iWatch. This thing does me no good.
iWatch is... Dr. Jen Donahue, what goes in your backpack?
I would basically put in self-awareness, but also a calculator. So,
do you use a paper one with a paper tape? Do you have a paper generating calculator often or no?
I do not. I do not. I just have my HP that I've had for many, many years.
Guy that I work with still uses like an adding machine type calculator, like all the time with the little tape rolls. It's
I'm not going to tell you how long it was before I figured out that if you turn the calculator on your iPhone sideways, it could get all the financial calculator options. I did not know that.
It's a good thing to have. Yeah,
for sure.
Bella Mejia Carter, what are you going to add to our backpack?
I'm going to add a reminder to stay present.
It's always
to slow down, important. To stop fighting, to let go, to trust life, and to be there, to be on the trail.
Let go is a very, very, very important thing to have
not
on there as well.
Not a slide rule, says Coach Witters.
Not a slide rule.
Calculator to calculate how much self-awareness you have.
Do you know, my first experience with a calculator is my grandfather had a very old-timey adding machine. And one day I was in there really working it over. It was like manual typewriter kind of adding machine. It was like clacky clack with the doodads that come up. And I got it stuck and I got in some real trouble. But my grandmother fixed it. Let me tell you how. It's a good engineering story.